This is a Stimulus Network podcast.
The Cosmic Shed.
Hello and welcome to The Cosmic Shed. I'm Andrew, and in today's episode, we're going to be talking about Flight of the Navigator.
Nothing David Freeman has ever experienced will prepare him for the adventure that lies ahead.
Sit down.
I think there's been some sort of mistake.
Your brain contains data necessary to get me and my friends home.
I'm just a kid.
You are the Navigator.
Walt Disney Pictures presents a new adventure fantasy.
What are you doing?
Above and beyond the ordinary.
Take me back.
Okay.
Oh, no!
Flight of the Navigator.
Do something!
You're the Navigator, not me.
20,000 feet and falling.
Come on, one of these hasn't started.
His mind is the key to an adventure on the most fantastic hot rod in the universe. A story of a spaceship.
That flying saucer's first rate.
Be cool, dudes.
A friendship.
I'm gonna miss you.
I'm going to miss you, too.
And an experience beyond imagination.
Don't you want to take a turnpike?
I'm the Navigator.
Flight of the Navigator. Disney's new adventure fantasy.
Lisa Downs is a filmmaker who's just finished Life After Flash, a documentary all about Sam Jones and his life after Flash Gordon, and is now making Life After the Navigator. Catching up with Joey Kramer, who played David. We'll hear from Lisa later in the podcast, and Joey's life has taken a bit of a turn with drug addiction and a few arrests, including spending time in a correctional centre. But before we talk about life after the Navigator, there's a bit of science news which you've probably heard about life on the moon. But it is life that we have put there. It's caused a bit of a stir among the scientific community. And there's only one place that we would go when we wanted to talk about life in space. And that's friend of the Cosmic Shed and astrobiologist at the European Space Agency, Dr. Nicole Kaplan.
In April this year, the Israelis sent their lunar lander, the Bereshit spacecraft, to the moon with the intention of landing on the lunar surface. However, it didn't quite make it. They lost contact with the craft minutes before it was meant to touch down, and as a result, it crash-landed. On this spacecraft, there was a very special payload sent by the Ark Foundation. Now, the ARC Foundation are an organization based in Los Angeles. They have the goal of projecting the culmination of all human knowledge out into space, and also perhaps more bleakly, to provide a backup plan for if humanity goes under.
Okay.
This Israeli craft is a commercial venture, and the ARC Foundation is the brainchild of CEO Nova Spivak. So he saw this opportunity to get his payload, which consisted of reams and reams of information, into specially digitalized forms of a huge amount of Wikipedia articles, information about the origins of life as we know it, evolution, all the way through to societal factors like religion and language. The Israelis knew that this was going to be on the payload. However, they didn't realize that there was also going to be biological samples installed. And this is where it gets juicy, because there was no mention of these samples. These samples are microscopic, and they're encased in multiple layers of metals, nickel, and epoxy resin. Okay. So unless you tore it apart and analyzed it, you wouldn't have been any wiser. So this payload was then inserted into the Bereshit craft and sent to the moon. So inside this biology payload, there are also tardigrades. A tardigrade is also known as a water bear, or cuter still, a moss piglet.
Oh, cool. I didn't know that one.
And they're hardy creatures, ubiquitous in our environment. They are found in ponds, mosses, lichens, and they are very well known for surviving extreme conditions. Now, because of this, ESA sent a payload of tardigrades into low Earth orbit for 12 days in 2007. And upon retrieving the samples when they came back to Earth, they analyzed them and it was found the tardigrades survived not only exposure to these harsh temperatures, not only exposure to space vacuum, but also radiation.
Really? But they didn't have spacesuits on?
They didn't have spacesuits on, but they were sent in the dry, desiccated state.
Oh, okay.
So it's the common misconception that you could pluck a tardigrade out of a pond and drop it into some boiling water. That's not the case. In order for a tardigrade to survive the extreme environment, they have to enter this stasis-like condition. They have to go into a, what's called a tun, which is where they ball themselves up and they dry out.
Okay.
So metabolism is completely decreased, and they just exist and they don't do anything.
And do they come back again into their state afterwards?
So then you would hydrate them, and then upon hydration you could then put them in boiling water or a freezer or subject them to an immense amount of radiation.
Okay.
But only after they're through that hibernation stage. You couldn't pluck them out, otherwise they would suffer shock.
Okay.
But if I plucked you out of your chair and put you into some boiling water, you'd be pretty shocked.
I'd be pretty shocked, yeah. But if you desiccated me first, then I'd probably be...
If I desiccated you first, I'm not sure you would survive either. And that's what makes tardigrades really interesting.
Yeah, no, that's really cool, isn't it? So are they everywhere? Like in every pond? There's two ponds outside the cosmic shed. Could there be tardigrades in them?
Go get them. They are absolutely everywhere.
Oh, really?
The method of extracting them, I mean, you could try and get a scoop of pond water and look for them in that, but you're more likely to find a nice population of tardigrades if you harvested some moss or scraped off some lichen and soaked it, and then the tardigrades would be released from that because they're eating the moss and they're eating the lichen. So that's their food source and that's where you'll find them. They are food motivated and I really identify with that.
Fair enough. But right, so is this a problem? Is this a problem, putting this biological stuff on the moon?
Well, in the state that they were sent, no, because as I explained, they were in this epoxy resin. Now, if you were to somehow, maybe the spacecraft upon impact, everything shattered, the resin broke open and you had these dry tardigrades now on the lunar surface, the only way they would be activated is via hydration. Now, theoretically, if somehow, and we know there's no water on the moon, but somehow it rained on the moon, or if a comet laden with ice made its way for a moon crater and somehow hydrated the tardigrades, you would maybe see some survival for about a week, because there's no food source for them either. Unless they find their way to some Apollo astronaut feces. There's no food source for them.
Okay.
And radiation would kill them.
Okay.
Because they would be exposed to full solar light. And it's the UVC in particular that gets them. UVA and B, they can survive. They don't do very well in, but it's the UVC that they really need sunscreen against.
Okay. But why did the Arc Foundation want to send them to the moon?
They want to send as much information, be it knowledge of biology, just out into space, just in case. So this is where the sci-fi comes in. If an alien entity managed to get to the moon, they would be able to find all of this information. Now, I spoke directly to Nova Spivak, the CEO of the Arc Foundation. And I posed the question to him. I said, have you not thought about the potential consequences of sending reams of information, everything we know about humanity, out into the cosmos? If there were some aliens that picked them up, could they not use that information against us? And he very brilliantly said, look, we've put them on the moon. If aliens did manage to get to the moon, that's very close to Earth.
Yeah.
I think they would just pick us off instantly. Yeah. Or maybe they're slightly timid. They would pick up the information. And also, how would they know what to do with it in the format that it's in? It depends what kind of cognitive development they possess.
Yeah.
if the goal is not for aliens to pick it up, perhaps it's for spacefaring humans in future to have this library of information that would not exist on Earth because Earth no longer exists.
This is like, it's like burying a time capsule in the garden for the future.
Potentially.
Yeah. Cosmic time capsule, that's pretty cool. So, yes, if there are any aliens listening, then in the Sea of Serenity is where you want to go. Take some moss and lichen and some water, and you've got some ready-made tardigrades. Yeah, how long will they live for in a metal box in this desiccated state on the moon?
So it's been reported that they can actually live in a desiccated state around 30 years. Now, with the extremely low temperatures that the moon could have in places, especially in a crater shadow, there's nothing to say that the combination of being desiccated and frozen couldn't extend that shelf life.
Okay. Oh, extend it. Okay, cool.
So maybe beyond 30 years.
Yeah. So maybe we'll get back to the moon before they are gone.
Maybe.
Yeah. With the caveats aside, are you generally in favour of sending biological samples onto other moons and planets?
COSPAR, the Committee for Space Research, they have guidelines about the different planetary bodies, and they categorise them in terms of how scientifically interesting they are for understanding the process of chemical evolution or the origin of life. Now, the moon is a category one destination, and that means that it's not of direct interest. And so that this payload that was sent there wasn't in any breach of that. However, it wouldn't be the same case for Mars. Now, Mars is very scientifically interesting. We know that there was once water. So there is the theory that we could go in search for life. And that's what ESA are planning to do with the ExoMars rover. They're sending a rover with a drill that can go 2.5 meters into the subsurface. And that is where we think we might find life, or what once was life. I wouldn't complicate the picture by sending tardigrades to Mars.
Yeah, no, fair enough. I should probably let you go, but before you do, there's an open day at ESA.
There is. So on the 6th of October, we will open our doors to the public, and it's the ESTEC site in Noordwijk in the Netherlands, and it's not far from Amsterdam. You can get your tickets on the ESA website. They're free, and they are being released, I believe, at the end of this month of August. But they will sell. I say sell, they're free, but they will sell out very, very quickly. But it will be a fantastic event, as it was last year. We have lots of activities for families, for space nerds and non-space nerds alike.
I like the way you kind of looked at me when you said space nerds.
So maybe you should be our cover picture for the day.
Here's a space nerd. Join him at ESA Open Day.
Yeah. We'll definitely have stormtroopers as well. We always have stormtroopers.
Yeah, of course. You got Matt Taylor. Will he be dressed as a stormtrooper? That's the question.
I hope so. I mean, he has the last few years, and I'd be disappointed if he wasn't.
Yeah, absolutely. And with your headphones on, you do a mean Princess Leia.
Thank you very much for the compliment.
Brilliant. Thank you very much indeed.
Fantastic. Thank you for having me.
Thanks, Nicole. And obviously, we'll post links to the ESA Open Day on the Cosmic Shed website, thecosmicshed.com. But let's get to Lisa Downs and her film Life After the Navigator.
Acting is a journey of self-discovery. The environment has allowed me to really be myself and be vulnerable and be open and just do what I love.
I mean, this is a home that we've created, a safe environment for you to be able to feel free and to fly with a skill that you were given as a child. And now coming back, you know, that flight is so much more powerful as a man, right? Yeah.
Don't we all deserve love?
I was towards the end of Life After Flash, and I always knew that this Life After concept was a series that I wanted to do. So I was like thinking about different films that I grew up with. I'm very nostalgic as a person and I love reminiscing and I love rewatching films that bring back the memories of when I first watched them. So I was like, okay, well, what films can I do? And there are a couple in the works that I won't say just yet. But whilst doing those ones, I was thinking, okay, these are kind of more long-term ones. What else can I do that maybe I could action straight away? And I was on the way to a birthday party and I was just thinking, what films do I absolutely love from my childhood? And then I thought, Flight of the Navigator. I had just watched it like a couple of weeks before and it was still as fantastic as when I remember watching it when I was a little girl. And fans of the film, if you have gone on Wikipedia to Google whatever happened to Joey Kramer, it's not the greatest outlook on his life. And, you know, when you grow up with this child that you wanted to be friends with and you thought you could be friends with, and then you suddenly read all this stuff that's happened to him and you see the mugshot, I just thought, I know that this has to be the next one.
We'll come to his story in a sec as well, but there's... So tell me why you love the film.
It's so hard, especially if you're describing the film to someone who like hasn't seen it before, has seen it as an adult. You can't just say, you know, it was great at special effects, because at the time, like even though it was really in the forefront of special effects with that morphing technology, when you're a little kid, you're not really aware of that. So like now when people talk about their favorite films, it's, you know, the cinematic vision and the shots and the, you know, and it wasn't like, it was just it, when you're a kid, it takes you into this world of fantasy and you want to be friends with David and you relate and go, well, what happened? What if this happened to me? Like, what if I was taken away and came back and my parents were 10 years older and, you know, and you go on this adventure and it's just like the magic and the soundtrack. And even now it's, when I hear the soundtrack, the hairs on my arms stand up on end, and it just takes you straight back to this feeling of when you're a child. So it's really hard to say like technical things about the film that I love. It's the feeling of how I felt watching it as a kid when I was, you know, 6, 7, 8 years old.
Alan Silvestri wrote the soundtrack, right?
He certainly did. And yeah. Didn't he do well for a career?
Yeah, didn't he? Didn't he? I guess there's one thing. Like, I know what you mean. It does take me back to that. And I love it for that. But it's not Back to the Future soundtrack, is it?
No. It's Flight of the Navigator soundtrack.
you're going to push me on this. That's fine. So what I mean is, it's slightly like I want to put on my leg warmers and do a little bit of aerobics.
If you're just putting on the CD, yes. But in the context of the film, and it's not just listening to the track, it's listening to the track and knowing where it is in the film and what's happening at the time of the film. And you hear the opening song and you go, oh, it's the dogs with the frisbees and, you know, it's about to happen. And then you hear another track and you go, this is when David like falls down the ravine. And so in itself, I agree with the leg warmers, but as a whole, as a package, you know, it's again, it kind of, music can take you to a place and remind you of things. So that's what I meant about the music.
Okay, cool. Okay, I'll let you have that. like Flash Gordon and Flight of the Navigator, they're both science fiction.
That's a coincidence.
So that's not where it's all going to
go. No.
Okay, that's a shame. But
well, it might be, but that's not, you know, it's not the plan.
But they're both, how should I put this, not Star Wars. So yeah. they're both kind of a time.
Well, now, if you have seen Life After Flash, you will discover that it was actually George Lucas wanted to get the rights to Flash Gordon and couldn't get them. So wrote Star Wars because of that. So it could be that Star Wars is like Flash Gordon a little bit.
But do you know what I mean? There's not, it's not, they're no, how do I say it? They're not absolutely perfect. And, you know, the opening sequence, as wonderful as it is also slightly kind of, I hesitate to say this, naff.
But it's of its time. Yeah, I think that's what's charming about it, you know, and that's what would cinema be if a film didn't reflect that time, you know, if everything was trying to be 20 years in the future and then try and be all the same. And, you know, it's part of the joy of watching something again as well and going, oh, look at, like, I even saw Titanic the other day. I was like, those special effects aren't what I remember them to be, you know, like I can see the kind of green screen key around it. And it's, you know, and it's not how I remembered it on the big screen being this magical thing, because film has evolved so much, but it still doesn't take away from, I think, it being a great film. So I quite like that you can kind of watch something and go, off Flash Gordon, it's so camp and colorful, and I can't believe they would do that, because people wouldn't do that now. It would be considered naff. You know, I think that's part of the charm.
Oh, I agree completely. I'm just asking the question, really.
It is interesting. You know, it's funny to go back and watch films this many years later and actually be in a position where you can kind of pick at certain elements that you may not have 30 years ago.
Who have you been speaking to then for the documentary?
Well, funny you should ask that. So we started production last year, about a year ago, and that was initially just Joe. So I had contacted him. It was quite hard to find him because all I had to go on was the Wikipedia page. So he was still in a correctional center at the time. So I had found the courthouse that he had gone to, found the court records, worked out what his sentence was, called the correctional center, had to leave a message and hope he would call me back. His mum phoned me back with his address. So we became pen pals while he was in the correctional center, which was really sweet because I, you know, a child of the 80s and the 90s, I miss letter writing and getting letters in the mail. So that was really fun for me. So we became pen pals, and then he was like super up for it, and we were chatting about what we would do with the film, and he plays music too. So we were saying it'd be really great, you could write some songs like to connect parts of your life. And so he was getting really excited. And then when he was released, we made a plan and I went over to see him for a few days, which is where we shot the initial trailer. And then off the back of that, I contacted Randall Kleiser, who directed the film, who also did Grease, which I was very excited about because that is another of my favorites of the time, but it still holds up today, give or take a few things. But I absolutely adore it. So it was really great to meet him. And we interviewed him at his office where he has two of the model ships from the film, which was really great to see. So the two of them initially, and then Randall was really great and so supportive of this project that we kind of were chatting, and he is now officially on board as one of the executive producers of the film, and was very kind to say, hey, look, Joe was in LA for something else. And one of the things that I had said when I met Randall was, well, I really want to get you and Joe back together. Capture that moment. They hadn't seen each other for about 20 odd years. Joe was an extra in one of Randall's films in the mid 90s, and that was the last time they saw each other. So I said, I really would like to capture this on film. And he emailed me and said, hey, look, Joe is obviously in LA. Why don't I set up a reunion with everyone? I was like, well, yes, please. That would be really great. So actually, at the end of June, I flew over. And we had set up Joe initially on for an interview, and then we arranged that Randall would come in halfway through the interview and surprise him. And so we did that, and we got that all on film. And so we got them chatting, and then Randall, bless his heart, he's so kind, he arranged. So his brother, Jeffrey Kleiser, did all the special effects, also on Tron, I might add. He is super talented. So we interviewed him. From the crew, we interviewed a couple of the producers. We interviewed the guy, Tony and Tim, who were the puppeteers for Puckmarin and Max. And Tim was the voice of the Puckmarin as well. So he was doing his little Puckmarin sounds and had a little doll, and it was really cute. And then from the film, we interviewed Raymond, who was the officer in the car the officer who took Joe to pick him up and took him back to the house. And then we interviewed the little brother, Jeff, who was very cool. The dad, Cliff DeYoung, Veronica Cartwright, the mum. And then Matt Adler, who played the older Jeff, couldn't make it. So I went and interviewed him the next day, which, and that to me, actually, I have to say, was one of the most exciting things because he was in Dream a Little Dream, which is one of my other ultimate films with the two Coreys. I'm a big two Coreys fan. So there were many highlights in that, but just to be in this room where all these people are surrounded and you're suddenly standing there and the Freeman family is kind of standing right in front of you. And I was like, I don't know what's happening, but so it was really great. And we had the whole day and we sat everyone down and we interviewed everyone and we captured part of the reunion. And it was a really special day. So cool. Yeah. And then there's obviously other casts that we're going to get to later on who couldn't make the reunion.
Okay.
So you're literally in the middle of making
it. Yeah. I'm currently trying to raise funds to get back out to do the last leg of filming.
Okay. On the basis that nobody listens to the ends of podcasts, tell us how people can fund it.
I don't have a way yet. Just email me. Okay. So I had crowdfunded for Flash, and as grateful as I am for all the people that put in money for that, and it was a great way to raise funds for my first film. It is so hard and it's so much work, and I just thought I really don't have it in me to do it again. So I have just been approaching individual investors to come on board this as an investor as opposed to a backer. So send me an email if anyone wants to come on board. So we've got a couple more weeks shoot to do back in North America.
How do people email you?
So at lisa@sparechangefilms.co.uk.
Cool. All right. Do that, everyone.
Yay. Hello. Thanks, everyone.
I'll try and find some money at the back of the show.
Just a fiver. Yeah. But, you know, it's so hard to, you know, try and work out ways to raise money for films. So it's always like anything. I'm so grateful. We're a very lo-fi crew, so it kind of works well.
Yeah. You should make podcasts, then you don't have to go anywhere. You just do it over Skype.
Well, that's true. I mean, I could interview everyone through Skype is another option, but
it's not quite as good a film, though, is it, in the end? You know, because, like, you're in Life After Flash, you're kind of, I don't know if it's you, but there's a camera walking along with Sam chatting away, and he's doing all sorts of wonderful things that I don't know if he just does when there's a camera not around, but he was
genuinely doing. That is him.
But that you wouldn't get that over Skype, would you?
No, you're very true. Just someone's carrying a laptop next to him trying to capture everything with the Wi-Fi connection. But you're very right. So no, that is exactly why I haven't done it.
Pretty much. No, fair enough. Just to go back a bit. So why was Joe in prison or correctional center?
He robbed a bank.
Cops nabbed
former child star Joey Kramer, best known for his role in Disney's Flight of the Navigators, has been arrested in Canada in connection with a bank robbery. The 42-year-old faces several charges, including robbery, failing to stop for a peace officer, and dangerous operation of a motor vehicle. Constable Harrison Moore of the Royal Canadian Mounted.
Under these bridges,
I felt like bad for people who loved the movie. But no one felt like I would like that I let a lot of people down. Growing up to and that I thrown out and used and that's not me. Alone and abused.
Just fighting to survive. You have to watch the film to find out why he robbed it and the story leading up, because it was not what I expected at all. And the poor guy has just been to the ends of the earth and back. And I cannot believe that he is still around now.
Yeah.
He shouldn't have been. There were certainly moments where he nearly wasn't. And it's so great to know him now, because you can see he's such a beautiful person and a beautiful soul, and the place that he's in now is so great. And yes, you know, addiction is always there, but he's been clean since coming out of the correctional center, and yeah, he robbed a bank.
So every morning, I've got to go to the pharmacy for my methadone, and that's because when I was with, it's to help you get off heroin.
So I'm really sorry about this, but did have you asked him whether he wishes he had a time machine?
I don't think in so many words. I've asked him if he regrets it, but his outlook on life is you just learn from everything, and you know, he wouldn't be where he is today without going through what he went through. Same as Sam, you know, what the lessons that you learn. It's, you know, it's that old classic phrase of, you know, it's not how you fall, it's how you get back up. And where he's at today, he's stronger than I think where he would have been if certain things didn't happen to him. And it's the most incredible story, and I'm so excited to share it with people. I really am.
So when? That's my question, when?
We hope to have it finished by the end of the year or early next year, is the plan. And that's... if anyone is interested, the original film is being re-released on Blu-ray the end of August, 4K, and they've got interviews with some of the cast as well and storyboards, and I think that's just a UK release. So.
Okay, cool. That sounds good. You mentioned Tron there. We're doing a double bill of Tron. We're calling it Tronfest.
Nice. I see what you did there. It's clever.
Thanks for that.
Yeah. But we're doing it for charity, so I should probably mention that. It's a wonderful charity called Special Effect, and they just, if anybody with a disability gets in touch with them who wants to get into gaming, like, for example, all of their mates play Fortnite and they want to but they can't, then Special Effect will work to make a gaming system that enables them with whatever their disability.
Oh, that's
to
be really able to play sweet.
Yeah.
So and if people want to donate to that, where can they donate money?
That's very good.
Well, Special Effect, you can find them through the Cosmic Shed website, or the best way to donate to them is to buy a ticket for Tronfest, because all the money that we make is going straight to them. I'm really excited about Life After the Navigator.
Me too. I genuinely am so excited to make it as well, because it's my weird way of being able to celebrate these things that I grew up with and that are really important to me. And I, you know, instead of just sitting in a pub telling someone drunkenly how great the film is, I can like show people through, you know, the trials of independent film making. So I think getting drunk might just be easier, but I am genuinely really excited about this one.
Can I ask you a personal question? Is this your job all the time?
No.
Okay.
It will, I mean, do I spend like all my days doing it? Yes. And am I being paid? No. So it depends what you define by job. It keeps me busy. Yeah. So, I mean, Flash really started was evenings and weekends fitting in interviews, and I would take days off to go and do interviews. And then it just got to the point that I had to quit work and do nothing but that, because I was editing it as well, because I couldn't afford an editor. So that took me into quite a desperate place. So now I'm trying to balance this one with work and doing this.
Anybody who's listening, we should try and make it so that it's possible for you to just do this.
Because, that would be lovely.
Right? Because is there anybody who listens to The Cosmic Shed who doesn't think that every 2 years we should get a film that
yes!
revisits an 80s classic?
Yes!
In the life.
I mean,
surely that's what we want.
Yeah. I mean, I do have a list of films that I want to do Life After with. Flash took 4 years. I'm trying to slash that in half to do this in two. I think I'm coming up to about a year and a half now, so that could happen. Actually, I've got a very wonderful editor called Neil, who so kindly is giving his time in between his job to edit this one, so I can actually try and make it happen and not, you know, try and edit this as well.
Life After the Last Starfighter, please.
Okay, I'll take requests. I don't know if I can mention it. I won't mention it just in case. I'm not allowed to. I was going to say a friend of this guy that we worked on with Flash, who's so brilliantly talented. He's the prop collector in the film, and he did the opening titles, he did the posters, like 20 different posters. He's so talented. He's doing his own life after of his favorite film after being involved in this one. So there is another life after happening in the background that I'm indirectly involved with.
Okay.
Yeah.
You're okay with that.
I think it's brilliant. I think he's brilliant.
Okay.
Yeah.
That's good. So Life After Flash, go on, tell us about it.
Well, so Life After Flash is the feature documentary that celebrates Flash Gordon, and it's pretty much what happened to Sam since the film. He surprised me. It's so hard when you're going into these types of films that all you have to go on is Google. And there's only so much you can learn about a person on the Wikipedia page, which was what happened with Joe. The first interview I had with Joe was 4 hours, and maybe two lines was from the Wikipedia page, and the rest of it was just incredible. So the narrative with Sam, I didn't know what the story would be. And the hardest thing about it was a lot of my friends who were in the industry as well were saying, well, if there's no drama, if there's no story, why are you bothering? And so I started to doubt it a lot. But as the interviews went on, he started to open up about certain areas of his life, and he had been very open and gave me access to his family and friends, and it was really all of them who shared his story. And then I went back and spoke to Sam, and he was just totally honest. And yeah, it's a really beautiful story of his fall from Hollywood, his blacklisting from Hollywood, and his redemption and where he is now and what he learned. And you know, his son in the film says, you know, everyone's saying, where's Flash Gordon been? But, you know, he was busy being a father and a husband, and he didn't fall off the face of the earth. Like, he was working really hard. He's got 5 kids, and he realized that his priorities were going to change. And because of that, the way he was thinking, everything started to change for him, and it turned into a positive, and he started attracting work again in the industry. And I'm really proud of it. It's a really great story, I think, of him being so open and honest, which you maybe wouldn't expect from a, you know, quote, superhero.
Cool. And how can people watch that?
People can watch that. Well, so you can buy the DVD and the Blu-ray, which I put a lot of effort into all the special features on those two discs. And Bob Lindemeyer did the artwork and the little booklet in the Blu-ray. So they're on lifeafterflash.com. In the UK, it's streaming on Vimeo. In the US, it's on Amazon Prime. And in the UK, it's going to come out on Amazon Prime soon too, anyway.
But people should buy the disc, right?
Pete, you know what? It may be a dying art that people say, but I'm really proud of the discs. And you can take them to cons. You can get them signed. They're practical. You can use them as posters in the house. They have many, many facets of use, as well as being a collector's item.
Totally. Well, look at that behind me.
There you go.
I mean, seriously.
I'm such a fan of physical copies. I have vinyl. I have my CDs from 20 years ago, the same CDs that I've had since, like, when I first bought my Dream a Little Dream soundtrack when I was 13. And, you know, where everything just disappears into the cloud these days, and I don't know where it goes, and it drives me nuts. So physical copies all the way.
Is there any films that you'd like to do but you can't?
I tell you one that probably I don't think would ever happen that I would love to is The Lost Boys. Because two Coreys, there was a book on it done, and I feel like with the rumours that are going around about certain people, staff who worked on it, like high up, I don't think that will happen, but I would just love to do The Lost Boys. I think it's brilliant.
Thank you so much, Lisa, for talking to me. And I don't know about you, but I cannot wait to see the full film of that. And I wish Lisa all the luck in the world with putting the last bits together. Don't forget to get your tickets for Tron Fest. The double bill will be showing Tron and Tron Legacy at the Winston Theatre in Bristol on November the 2nd. And we're going to be joined by Pete Etchells, who wrote the book Lost in a Good Game. And you know us, there'll be quite a lot more besides that. We'll see you there, I hope. And get your tickets at thecosmicshed.com. And thank you very much for listening.
The Cosmic Shed.
Science fact.
Science fiction.
And everything in between.
This podcast is brought to you by the Stimulus Network.